In many Chinese sayings, 10,000 is used in a poetic sense to convey something infinite, vast, and unfathomable. Hi, this is Dre McKesson. I want to tell you about a podcast that I think you will love, 10,000 Things, hosted by poet and museologist Shen Yi Pai. Each episode explores a collection of objects and artifacts that tell us something about Asian American life, from a body-conscious dress to a jar of water collected from the Ganges River. 10,000 Things is a vibrant, diverse, and bittersweet celebration of Asian America, and a challenge for all of us to reimagine stories of the past and future. Listen and subscribe to 10,000 Things wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Positive People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda talking about the news with regard to race, justice, and equity that you might not have heard last week, or news that you did hear but didn't hear from this perspective. Make sure you join our community on Instagram at Pod Save the People, and here we go. The Crooked Store has a bunch of great new merch, including new designs for our classic Friend of the Pod tee. This merch drop is part of a big upgrade at the Crooked Store. The site got a makeover and so did the merch itself, but don't worry, it's a good makeover, not like the time you cut your own bangs. All Crooked merch is now made from higher quality, more durable materials with modern fits and more sustainable manufacturing practices. See the new site and grab a new Friend of the Pod tee at the same old URL, crooked.com/store. Feels like we've been gone for a long time, but it is good to be back. And as you can imagine, a lot has happened in the weekish that we've been gone. This is Dre at D-R-A-Y on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Pharaoh Rapture on Instagram.
And I'm Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on LinkedIn or on Spill at BossierS.
Let me just say, I do hate that we just have to talk about the president so much because he is the president and so much of what he does impacts so many of our lives, especially with ICE running rampant and wreaking havoc in people's communities. I think about his recent denials of FEMA aid to places like North Carolina that supported him. And I don't know if you saw the devastation in St. Louis that happened and there's no FEMA. But I will tell you, the one thing that stood out to me recently was about Joe Biden and his cancer diagnosis. And when I saw the tweet, I was like, Trump didn't say that. I'm like, that just feels crazy for even Trump to say.
He's been a sort of a moderate person over his lifetime, not a smart person, but a somewhat vicious person, I will say. If you feel sorry for him, don't feel so sorry because he's vicious. What he did with his political opponent and all of the people that he hurt a lot of people, Biden. And so I really don't feel sorry for him.
I'm like, wow, this is really something for him to be joking about Joe Biden's cancer diagnosis. And he said other things about it in that same sort of clip. But I was like, what? Yeah. And people are just like, it's like another day. He's like, don't feel sorry for him, kid. You're like, the president of the United States is being like, hope he dies. You're like, that feels, I know it's not the biggest thing at all Trump has done, but I don't know. I just wanted to bring it here because I saw that and was like, what?
Dora, you're such a cutie sweetie. that's the first thing I would say. Because I was like, that is not the most gangster thing that Trump has said to me. But I do think, how I read it and how I heard it when I heard him say it, I think that although Trump is funny, I don't think he's always joking. I think that he sees life as a type of Monopoly game. I think that he sees death and illness as a type of failure. And I think that he sees it as somebody else who, like, I'm trying to talk white collar. To me, I just think he sees his life as, like, as you know, some executives get fired, and that's how it goes as long as I'm ascending. So I think that it just speaks to how he sees life and values life.
I was thinking about, you know, we've had some high-profile Republicans die over the last handful of years. Like, I'm thinking about, like, when Barbara Bush died and other folks were like, we can't say mean things about them. You know, they were still people, blah, blah, blah. And there's this interesting thing that I think happens on the left where people are like, you know, death is so final. Maybe they were on a road to redemption. We shouldn't dance on their graves. And my reaction to hearing that clip from Trump was, it reminded me of Tupac's energy at the end of Hit 'Em Up, you know? And I was like, oh, Trump is like Biden as a staff, as a record label, and as a crew. And if you want to be down with Joe Biden, then you to. And I just am like, he just brings that energy to the presidency, to everything he does, really. And I'm just really amazed that people think that you can go up against the presidential POC, which I'm finna get in trouble for saying, and like that your response to that is supposed to be something about decorum and civility. It's just wild to me that that's where we're still at on the left.
I mean, I think online, you know, my favorite white woman, the Tory, Tory. What's her name?
Oh, Taylor Lorenz.
Taylor Lorenz. Yes, I be calling her woke Katy Perry in my head. And I need to stop. That's why I don't remember her name. But she was talking about how it was really about the someone's got to do it memes, and how inside of those memes there lives a certain type of distaste or temperature or hostility that we can register around it. And I think that moments like this, I see the same type of hostility being registered, where it's like, no, we're living in an era where I don't think there's as many people who are as buttoned up as we want to imagine. That feels like something that people want to imagine. But when I see it, I'm like, no, I see people over here drinking beers, talking about how they're glad a CEO got shot. Yeah. I see people over here saying, fuck him. I hope my meemaw and my mom and my auntie or whoever died of cancer three times over. And there's not free healthcare for all. I just think that this sentiment that there's decorum, I just think that's an illusion that it's not real. Like, there is no decorum. It's the Wild Wild West.
Miles, what's the somebody has to do a meme? Like, can you take me to the meme? Like, what was she saying about it?
As the resident young person who is just 26, I'm lying now. I know all about the internet. So on the internet, there's this meme around Trump saying somebody's got to do it. So this really took off on both X and on TikTok, where what's implied is somebody needs to, in algorithmic speak, unalive Trump in order for us to transcend this kind of political moment that we're in. And then so a lot of people caught on, and they're not necessarily saying it, but some they're saying instead, somebody's got to do it. Who's going to do it? Somebody's going to do it. And we all know what they're saying.
What did Taylor say about it?
So what Taylor is saying about it is that this is symbolic for what's going on inside of people's and Americans' heart. So I think instead of it being like, you can't say that on the internet or that's wrong, we should examine why so many people are saying this and why people feel like it's okay to say this, and people of different political parties, different classes, different ages are feeling okay saying that. It's saying more about where we are as a public. Yeah.
Got it. And in the same vein around Trump, Sharonda, do you think his gangstiness extends to the pardons that he's doing? It feels like an overt play to try and get black men to be on his side by pardoning NBA Youngboy. He already did Kodak Black a while ago. Larry Hoover, he has said that he would entertain pardoning Diddy. And the quote was something like, because Diddy used to like me a lot. You're like, okay. And I don't know if you saw it. This is like how petty the beef is. 50 Cent was like, I'm going to call Trump and let him know, don't pardon that man.
Yes.
Like, y'all are just, what's going on?
This is, I think Trump leads the way that we think a crime boss or a gang leader would lead, right? And that is like through loyalty. I mean, we saw even this week, and like absolute loyalty, right? We saw even this week that he's announced that he's going to retract his, you know, nomination for the head of NASA, who was an Elon Musk pick, because he found out that that person, that man, had donated to Democrats in the past, right? Like, Trump is like all or nothing. You are in and 100% loyal to me, or you are not. And what people have figured out, and what a lot of these people that you just named and their teams have figured out, is like, if you kiss the ring, then the Don might pardon you. And it used to be that I think presidents thought a lot about the optics of who they pardoned, particularly people who had been convicted of violent crimes in the past. And he doesn't seem to care about that either. I mean, we're talking about people with gun charges. We've talked about people who've been convicted of murder and all sorts of other violent crime. And he's just like, whatever, they out, and who gonna check me, you know? So absolutely, I think his gangsterness extends to this list of pardons, especially this latest round.
Yeah, even with the how he redressed the White House or the Oval Office, right? It's because it's like so tacky and so like you don't get. What's interesting is you don't arrive at that type of Oval Office interior design without loving The Godfather or loving like countless gangster movies. So like in the blood coming from the ear, that image. So it is interesting to see what he thinks. Cause none of it, like I think even Larry Hoover was like a vanity, right? Like
yeah.
He, like nothing's actually going to happen. So it does seem interesting to think about who he's pardoning and what that, cause to me it's all wood for the fire. So it's just interesting to see, like, oh, this is who he's trying to align himself with now. And then you know how Trump works. In 6 months, you know, he'll create a law that totally undermines black men and black men who with these type of charges, if it fits. I guess right now it fits that he's aligned with certain types of people. It's sad.
And you know what? The Larry Hoover news is so interesting and a reminder of how the media participates in the myth of Trump, because the first headline was Trump pardons Hoover, and the sort of tone was like, Hoover's going to be free.
Right.
That was like the first reporting. And then you're like, oh, he got to finish
a 200-year state sentence
yeah. for a 73 Chicago murder. That man ain't going nowhere. And if anything, the only thing that's going to be different for him is that he is currently in solitary confinement, a supermax facility. But he will no longer be in a federal facility. But I can't imagine the circumstances in Illinois for somebody with such a long sentence is going to be any better. But, you know, a lot of people weren't reading, and they will be like, wow, look at him doing something for black people. And, you know, if you remember, do you know who's in charge of the pardons in the White House? Do you remember who he put in charge of the pardons? Alice Johnson, the black woman that he pardoned during his first term.
With Kim Kardashian.
With Kim Kardashian. So she is his shield for the pardons. So when she and he are pardoning black people, the activists on the left are like, well, look at what Alice did. So they aren't even critical of Trump in these moments because they're like, well, we need to support Alice. And you're like, y'all, he is using everybody over there as a pawn. He knows intimately well that the left cannot win if black people don't support the candidate. So picking off every percentage point actually matters a ton.
Is that what you think his long-term goal is? Is like the pulling more black people to the right? Like, I'm trying to figure out what the long-term play is. And like an election-focused strategy seems interesting since he doesn't want us to ever have an election again. So I'm like, do we really think that that's the long-term vision he has for how this will pay off?
I do. I think that I think people told him and he was down for criminal justice reform was the way to pull the black people the first time, which is why he did the first look, like whatever that act was called, the second look act, first look act. I should probably know it. But it's why Trump did the modest criminal justice reform that he did originally and why people like Alice Johnson got out because of Kim and stuff like that. I think that now he's like, well, the left will always do criminal justice reform better than me. So let's not even like enter that fight anymore. And frankly, the white supremacists don't like the criminal justice reform stuff. So instead, I'll just fight in culture and I'll win in culture. I'll like win enough that it'll make the numbers. So it's like, I think Saquon Barkley to me is one of the most interesting props of this moment. Because Saquon is like, I'm just playing golf. I play with all the presidents. And then what happens like clockwork? Trump is like, we are friends on Twitter. He's like, that's my friend. And you're like, he understands that you just need a sliver of black people and he can't get black women. That's not, the black women are like, absolutely not. So the only people you can get is black men, which is why it's NBA Youngboy, it's Kodak Black. This is why I actually think Diddy's not going to get pardoned. Because I think the Diddy thing is a little too, I don't know, it feels like it just won't be worth the backlash. Where it's like, who's mad at him for pardoning an NBA Youngboy? I'm like, nobody.
This is fresh out the oven, you know, so if this thought is still too doughy, then let me know. But I think sometimes the long-term plan is to have no long-term plan. I think that the chaos resolves itself, and we see that time and time again. So here it is. So you see that a lot of this happened right when Elon gets fired, right? And the Elon leaves. I think that these pardons are just an instrument, a note that he decided to play in order to cover that up. And whatever happens, happens. And because our brains are fried enough that we elected him again in 2024. So we're definitely not going to remember what happened 6 months ago. Like, it just, his choices don't seem to accumulate into strategy. They just seem to accumulate into chaos and using chaos as an instrument. And by the time you try to figure out or strategize why this happened or what he's trying to do when it comes to polls or what he's trying to strategize and what he's trying to get points down for, by the time that you figure out what the aftermath is, it just doesn't matter and you're on to the next disaster. And I think that's what this was too. I think the Larry Hoover, the NBA young boy, like all that stuff is because at the end of the day, Black people are going to talk about it. It doesn't really matter if you like it or if you don't like it. Y'all are going to talk about it. And that talk is going to be louder than the other failures that we were witnessing or often the other monstrosities that we're witnessing. So now we have a whole bunch of Black people who are not talking about what's going on in St. Louis. We have a whole bunch of Black people who are still not talking about what's going on in Lincoln Heights, Ohio and stuff. And that's what to me matters, because NBA Youngboy is not a organizing opportunity, no matter how you feel about it. But the things that he's distracting us from are, and I think that is the strategy.
That's a good frame, yeah.
Do you believe that, too, with the Chrisleys being pardoned, Todd and Julie? The stars of Chrisley Knows Best, that was on TV for 10 seasons.
If you watch The View, right, taking off the Negroes with NBA Youngboy and the Hoover, if you watch The View and you see all these women talk about this thing that just really doesn't actually matter for 10 minutes of not talking about the real things. You know what I mean? Like that, yeah, that works. As long as it's frivolous and it doesn't matter and you can't do nothing about it, then I can really do the real torture behind your back. I think that's the strategy. Using our own distraction of pop culture as a distraction for our political advancement.
Everyone who I know who loves the Chrisleys is a Black woman, because everybody thinks that Todd is hilarious and a mess.
And a homosexual, right?
And a closeted homosexual, correct. Okay. And I saw that clip of him and his daughter at the press conference because a Black woman sent it to me, right? And she was like, I'm so sorry. We really just might have to look the other way on this pardon, because this is going to be amazing TV.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Did you see that press conference where he talked about how the Black people in prison were not given the same things that he was getting access to, and the racial disparities in prison are a real crime? Did y'all see that?
Anyone that says that it's a fair shake, it's not. Because I dealt with young African-American males in the prison that I was in that were not treated the same. They were denied programming. They were denied access to certain things. I was not denied that. But we know why I wasn't denied that. And so I think that that is a much bigger picture that we all as a society as a whole need to look at, that we are one. And whether you're Republican, Democrat, or whatever, at the end of the day, when you're in that hospital, you don't care if it's a Democrat treating you or a Republican. Now, some of you may, but I want whoever's going to be the best person to do that.
I did not see that.
Okay, Pippi. He said, I know my audience. And just to... Sorry to keep on going back to this, because I just think you said a lot of things, DeRay, but the Alice Johnson piece too, and I've said it so many times here, but that digital minstrelsy era we're in, where you see Alice Johnson become victimized, wrongfully imprisoned person freed, and because she got absorbed into the celebrity machine, she got morphed into a mammy figure who's being used as the way that we excuse some of the ridiculousness. Like how if you're not critical about your place in the public space, it could be misconstrued and turned into minstrelsy so quick. I think wild.
I also think they're taking a page out of lessons from the Democrats, and that is you can be Todd Chrisley and say, if I don't want anyone to be critical of how or why I got a pardon, I just say Black people have it worse. And as long as I pay lip service to that, I'm good, right? Which is something that I think we've seen over and over again.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. You probably heard it reported in the news around the loneliness gap with regard to men, friendship gaps, what happened during COVID with people not being able to assemble and the impact that had on homes and men specifically. And you know, like I know, growing up, that there was such a big stigma surrounding men's mental health. This idea that men needed to be strong and providers, and that going to therapy or asking for help was somehow a sign of weakness. Now, it's no wonder that 6 million men in the U.S. suffer from depression every year, and it often goes undiagnosed. Y'all, it is okay to struggle. It is real to struggle. The real strength comes from opening up about what you're carrying and doing something about it so that you can be your best for yourself and everyone in your life. If you're a man and you're feeling the weight of the world, talk to somebody, anyone, a friend, a loved one, a therapist. Now, therapy has been huge for me because not only did I get feedback from somebody that's not a part of my life, but I'll tell you, just the other day, something happened and I was thinking about having to say it to my therapist. And it was in the act of saying the thing out loud that I'm like, oh, okay, I see what's going on here. And there are a lot of things about therapy that I feel like people didn't tell me, but I'm telling you, being able to talk it out, hearing your own voice say it is really powerful over and over every week that you go. That's why I'm here to talk about BetterHelp. With over 35,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally. And it works. With an App Store rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client reviews, and it is convenient. You can join a session with a therapist at the click of a button, helping you fit therapy into your busy life, and you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Talk it out with BetterHelp. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/people. That's betterhelp.com/people. Now, I will say, shifting topics dramatically, but still talking about the way Black attention functions, Kai Cenat, who I did not know existed until recently enough, like the streamer thing is not a... Like, I know him from the Shade Room, actually. I don't know. I've never seen I don't have a Twitch account. I don't know the other streaming platforms, but I know him almost exclusively from the Shade Room and from the way people talk about him on Twitter. But I did see the Streamer University stuff, and I was, like, intrigued by it. Again, all I know of him is what people talk about on Twitter and on the Shade Room. So when I see the clips, I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And I see that he's at award shows and a lot of events. But I bring him up because I want to know your take on the generational sort of moment around the streamers, because I don't know anybody in my generation who is a streamer. Like, I just don't know. That is new to me. And it seems like Streamer University was a big deal and that, you know, the networks pitched him on doing it and he said no. And so this is me trying to, you know, this is old man me trying to understand better what the kids are doing, because... And I don't dislike Kai. I actually don't have any strong feelings besides, like, I don't know what the thing is. It feels like somebody's on Instagram Live for days. That's, like, in my mind, that's what streamers do. Like, they just stay on Instagram Live and people sign up for it. But I just have never had the impulse to watch somebody on Instagram Live just live their life. I don't know. So, I wanted to bring it because it's something I'm intrigued by.
I first encountered streamers through my niece, who is now 14, who many years ago used to watch other kids play with the toys she had. And I was like, this seems weird to me. Like, I've bought you this thing and you watching other kids play with it. Why don't you just play with it yourself? So that's my first introduction to, like, streamers. There are some other, like, you know, podcasters, et cetera, or other kind of, like, more public figures who I think leverage streaming as a way of getting people hooked to them and then pushing them into some of their other content, right? Namely around kind of more political stuff. So it's like we start from this really soft place related to culture or shared interest around gaming or whatever else, right? You get to know me through that. And then you wonder what else I do. And then you find out that, like, I'm an abortions rights activist, right? And, like, now I've got you hooked to my cause. So there are some people I've never watched their streams, but I know leverage streaming as a way of, like, building their audiences for the other parts of their work. The first time I remember learning about Kai, though, was, like, learning a little bit, seeing him, like, on a Forbes list and realizing how much money he made streaming. And I was like, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing in my life. You know, maybe I did not need that master's degree, because what? And so even in reading about the Streamer University, you know, it's estimated he made $8.5 million in 2024, which is wild. And I think if you're a young person and you're looking at pathways to prosperity in our culture right now, doing something affiliated with building an online presence seems to be the most lucrative, the most accessible, and the most possible. And so he is positioning himself as someone who has like cracked the code and is willing to share it with you. It's the same way that, like, you know, we all want to go to Tony Robbins or Oprah Winfrey's seminars, right? Because we're like, they have achieved this level of enlightenment and I want that too. And so it makes total sense to me that young people would sign up for this and would feel like he's going to give me the cheat code and I'm going to be able to replicate this success. I think it's really interesting to think about his desire to keep it independent and not sell it to one of the big existing platforms. I think ownership is really important when we talk about Black creatives and Black creativity. I do wonder though, because I think we've seen this, if we're going to see some of these larger platforms or companies try and stand up competition to him and get behind someone to crush him for his unwillingness to sell the university to them or to do it in partnership with them. So that's actually, I think, what I'm going to be keeping a lookout for. It's like, are they going to let this Black man really thrive and do this and do something outside of the kind of big players in the space? Or are they going to organize around an attempt at either strong-arming him into a collaboration or crushing what he's built?
So when it comes to him in this like whole situation, and I'm thinking a lot about what DeRay said too, specifically because DeRay is just 5 years older than me, I believe. So like when you have a gap of somebody being for real, when you talking to somebody about age and that gap and stuff, you kind of look at those people who are like 5 years older than you to see possibility models. What does it look like? Okay. Stuff like that. And the reason why I bring that up is because I really do not like that our millennial generation, our Gen X generation, hell, even the boomer generation, so kind of relinquish power from these really powerful platforms that are being created. And I think when you look at it, so I have nothing personally against this man, but when you do look at his history, when you look about who he has aligned himself with, he is willing to do whatever he needs to do in order to make money. There is no Black feminist tone that he is obedient to. So what we're kind of seeing, in my opinion, is this kind of digital minstrelsy moment put on steroids and creating its own echo chamber, and people thinking that they aged out of certain technology and certain types of spaces, kind of relinquishing that power when we already know so much of the political and social power that we've been seeing has happened through the digital sphere. And we also are in a moment where we're seeing Facebook die, we're seeing X die, we're seeing Instagram be this kind of weird, at the best, like a strip mall, you know, where we could all see each other, but not really interacting how we should be. And when you see people like, I love that Hassan Piker, who's a white person who's 33, he's utilizing it. And then when you see Kai, I know Kai is like 23, utilizing it, it makes me sad that so many people of our generation, I'm not just thinking about DeRay, I'm thinking about just like our cohort of our generations kind of relinquish that power and what that's going to look like in the future. That deeply scares me. And the next thing is, and this kind of goes into my news that I guess I'll save to go deeper into it when I get to my news, but it also is showing how abysmal the hope for job security is in the future. When you look at where AI is going, when you look at where the digital economy is going and stuff like that, this is not just a hope and a dream how a rapper or a basketball player was during our generation. This is seen as a potential modality to leave your class position, and people are taking this dead serious, and people are becoming more, specifically when I'm thinking about young Black men, are becoming less charged by the idea of assimilating into college or into the workforce. So I don't know. It's just something, there's just so much there that I wish that we were bridging as a community across ages.
Miles, you might get me back on social media at the very least so I can stay tuned into some of that, you know?
But if not, I think that so many people, what's interesting, people at 23, 18, 19, they already think of themselves as brand. Like, to me, sometimes it's disgusting, but they're already talking about themselves as brands and platforms. And then when somebody who I meet who is good and grown, who really has a brand or platform, I'm like, if you don't plug that in, because in 20 years, nobody's going to care about the infographics. Like that's where we're going.
Oh, Jesus. It's interesting. You know, people call me every anniversary of a big death that went public around people killed by the police. And it's interesting. I'm talking to, I won't even name them, but I'm talking to one of the news sources. And it was interesting how lazy the storytelling was. Like, I know the reporters are lazy. So like, it is what it is. I'm not a Pollyanna about it, but I'm like, wow, after all of these killings, you still are asking me, did the numbers go up and down? And I'm trying to explain to you, like, there is no national police force that kills people. It's like local police departments. So I'm like, you know, some cities got better, some cities got worse. I don't really think it's helpful to say the overall number as the whole story. I don't think that's really helpful. And then the reporter is like, well, DeRay, talk to me about red states and blue states. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm not even trying to be slick, but, you know, the city police departments are killing people. So unless you do a city analysis by red and blue, I don't really know what. You know, you could call Georgia something, but Atlanta is not Georgia in that way. Or like Baltimore is not like, and they, but what gets printed in these big newspapers is like these really flat stories being like, numbers are really high. Look at all the places that voted for Kamala and the places that voted for Biden. And you're like, well, I don't really know if that tells us anything. And there are things that have happened that have been important. So I think that's my overall tone. The Time magazine thing was sort of whatever to me, but it's so interesting. And there's like another activist who I really like sent me this conference that I won't name. So I'm listening to it the other day and I'm trying to be positive. And I'm sitting here like, you know, 10 years after Mike Brown got killed, we're still listening to people who've never organized anything. I'm shocked by that. I'm like, you haven't even tried to convert the people in a barbershop. You know, you have like written all these essays and like, I'm confused by that. And then my last is I do have this enduring critique of the Academy. I think that while I had hoped that they would help us understand the scale of the problem better, they would help us understand like the structures around mass incarceration and policing. They didn't do that 10 years later. They just wrote essays about how they felt about race, and they wrote books to give us new language to talk about race. And they helped us theorize around Black death, all things that are interesting. But I look up and I'm like, if you Google right now, if you ask ChatGPT how many states have three strikes laws, it tells you 8. The actual answer is 19. If you ask ChatGPT where are those laws, it does not tell you. If you ask ChatGPT how many states have gang enhancements, it does not tell you. Like, there are all these things that I thought the Academy would use this moment to help us unearth and understand better. And instead, I can just find 10 more essays on the political significance of death and how anti-Blackness needs to be called anti-Blackness and not white supremacy. Like, and I'm not even, like, I am flippant about it, but I'm like, wow, that's what we produced. Essays and books and actually no better understanding of how the system works the way it does. That's my rant about 5 years after George Floyd was killed. But I'd love to know what you all think.
In my full-time role, I exist in the nonprofit sector. And there was this perception that the nonprofit sector found itself awash in all of this white guilt money on the heels of George Floyd's death in 2020. And I'm here to tell you as a fundraiser, that is not true. And as a person who leads a network of 1,300 other nonprofit leaders, for most of them, that's also not true. And so I think, you know, thinking about having dinners or marking milestones like this and trying to force us to look back on such recent history, I think, DeRay, just to build on your point a little bit, we have, one, no perspective and no privilege of perspective, because 5 years, while it feels like a long time in a lifetime, is actually not that long historically, right? But then I think, two, we have no way to assess progress or wins. Like, there's no kind of framework, right, for what are we actually looking for? What did we hope to achieve, et cetera, et cetera? And so, you know, in talking to some of the leaders that I have the opportunity to work with in my full-time gig about kind of where we are, what we want to say, like, did we even, you know, revise school discipline policies, right? In the wake of like George Floyd, because everybody was like, everything is up for discussion and revision and revisiting, et cetera. The answer is no. And so even in education, when we're looking at the disproportionately negative discipline data that impacts particularly Black students, we haven't seen progress there either. And I think what's fascinating to me is to think about a group of people getting together at universities and at black tie events to talk about how far we've come in the last 5 years. And for most people, myself included, and I want to note my relative privilege here, things don't feel better and there's no data that tells us that things are better.
It feels like y'all were swimming in my mind. It was so weird. It was times where DeRay and you were talking where I'm like, wait, am I talking out loud? Like, is this what exactly what's going on in my mind? I think, DeRay, you're so right, right? And A, as somebody who is a criminal of of that, as a writer, as somebody who thinks that having a basis of language is so important to be able to resist a thing and being able to like really know and name the monster you're trying to uncover, there is a limit to what language can do. Even Bell Hooks herself links that language is a place of struggle. But to your point, I don't know if we were watching, I doubt we were watching the same thing, but I was watching the Native Land podcast seminar thing. And I had the very thought to myself when I was seeing the Native Land panel, I was like, oh, this is what happens when you kind of professionalize and make academic Black struggle. It kind of turns into this essence brunch thing where people can talk and do monologues and where people can talk about what they're doing inside of maybe institutions for some people. But there is this a bite that's not there. There is a defanging that's there in our struggle that I just don't see how people don't name easier. Does that make sense? Like, I know that it's real because that has motivated me to stop writing. Like, so that has motivated me to write less because I didn't want to add to that noise. So I said, I want to figure out something else to do because this is no longer helping. There was a time where I thought this was helping. And now when I look at stuff like that, I'm like, no, if you're not using language to say the most biting thing you can say, the most cutting edge thing you can say with your thoughts, then you're not really using language. You're just using rhetoric. And when you're using rhetoric and jargon, people get hip to that, you know? And I think we're in a moment where people are getting hip to it. And I watch everything all the time. So I'm a avid listener to the Native Land podcast, and specifically in the last couple of episodes where Tiffany Cross has been. Not trying to be specific on them, but I thought they were such an interesting autopsy because I'm like, oh, here are three neoliberal Black folk who are finding the limits of what they put their life towards. And they're in reflection around, is this wasted work? Or should there have not been more strategy? And again, we could just do a whole podcast on it. I know my thoughts are a little jumbled around it because there's just so many different things that I think about where we have just not cultivated power. We cultivated the same professional dynamics that kill us in the office, that make people suicidal in the office. We just recreated it in movements for a lot of people, you know? And it hasn't gotten us anywhere. Last thing that I'll say about this too is, we kind of do all this talking and strategizing, and it feels like a lot of people also have a hard time seeing that still has to get permission from a Trump administration. That still has to get permission from a neoliberal Democratic administration that is not interested in cutting ties with AIPAC. I think we just have not reconciled that as a Black community, us being plugged into these systems and that being the first thing, electoral politics being plugged into that system, that is just not a fruitful venture for us. And I think we're just having a collective rude awakening, it feels like. Some people's awakenings seem ruder than others, though.
Yeah.
I will say, I agree with the majority of that up until the end, because and again, criminal justice policing is what I know the best, but you know, almost all of it happens at the local level where you really can make a big impact. Like even with schools and stuff, you can make a big impact at the local level with this. I mean, I think about those crazy book banning people. It's five women. You know, it's not even like, I thought it was a trade association of 1,000 people. It's five white women going around talking about banning books or what was it? Critical race theories. One random guy. You know, you're not even, this isn't even like a.
That's not true. Like.
What's not true?
That being five women, those things being one people, I believe that is, and what I've read is that is how the right crafts these stories, that these stories, they Rosa Parks in reverse. So just like Rosa Parks was seen as one woman, this is seen as just that's part of the public framing of these things. These things are orchestrated public distractions fueled by right-wing money and publicity that arrive to us as five people or one people.
I think that is true. And not like, I'll never forget Ta-Nehisi talking. He got invited. I don't know if you heard him talk about this, but he got invited to a community that banned his book. Mm-hmm. He walks in and he realizes it's like not a, you know, he's thinking he's going to meet this group of people who did it. And he was like, oh, it just wasn't a thing. He was, you know, it was like small group of people who actually had an outsized impact. And I think that is true for good and bad. I think that's certainly true in the criminal justice space. I say that to say that, and I do think there's a cost, but I don't think that it is futile on the local, like, the federal government is awash right now. I don't, you know, we just praying and hoping that we still here tomorrow. I don't think that that is true for the local. But the reason I want to come back to this is that I do think there's I'm annoyed by the Academy and the theorizing and the writers. Not just because I'm annoyed, but I think there's a real cost to it. Because what I see happening is that people have like theorized themselves out of their humanity. That's actually, so like I'm on a panel recently about police oversight. And with people that are very smart. And somebody says, well, oversight is not the answer, blah, 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 blah. What does it matter? This whole, and I'm sitting here like, I don't know. Like, when I talk to people, if the police beat the mess out of them, getting that person off the street, is that, like, that, you, it's not the biggest thing in the world. But to say it doesn't matter, I don't know. I don't believe that. As somebody who grew up in Baltimore where the jump out boys were jumping out of cars and snatching people off the sidewalk. The first thing I ever saw the police do was the jump out boys when I was 10 years old in my front yard, run this man down on a bike. So like, that matters. Or like when we do the thing into jail, people are saying to me like, why are you wasting your time with the kids at the jail? And I'm like, I don't think it's wasting my time. I don't know. Like, you know, I think that one of the interesting things that happened with the conversation about abolition is that it turned people who otherwise had no ideas about this stuff into really all or nothing people, that they're like, if you are not taking down the system today, nothing else matters. And it's like, well, all of the organizing that happens every day is like keeping people alive and helping them. And I don't know, something happened where like, I do think the Academy, like it was non-practitioners who pitted these ideas against each other, because there's no actual person I know who works in communities who like says those things.
And doesn't believe in harm reduction as a strategy or part of the strategy.
Yeah, like they would just, you would never poo-poo like helping out homeless people because homelessness didn't it. That would sound crazy to somebody who actually does the work. You know what I mean?
I think that local stuff, federal stuff, that's all great and it should happen. I think that we should be in community and strategy with Black people outside of those things. And I think because there's only so many limited ways that we can be in community with each other, there's not a whole lot of ways. So even as a writer, as me being who I am, it's hard to find ways to be in community with people in that way.
Yeah. One last thing before we pivot to my news, because I think in song lyrics is I think about all of the sort of legislation we tried to name after George Floyd and other people who've been killed by the state or by police. And it reminds me of Erykah Badu's AD 2000 lyrics where she says, you won't be naming no buildings after me to go down dilapidated. My name will be misstated. And I'm thinking about all of the ways that we, exactly. I think about all of the ways that we name things after people. And anyway, I feel like we should build a playlist after this because that's how my brain
absolutely
works.
Okay. Absolutely.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. Growing up, I loved cereal. Big, big cereal fan. Don't eat as much cereal as an adult because it's so much sugar in cereal. I'm like, I can't believe I ate all that sugar when I was a kid. But that's what actually got me to Magic Spoon, because Magic Spoon makes high protein, zero sugar cereal and treats. And it allows me to still do what I love as a kid, which is eat cereal, but it is so much better for me in a way that the cereal I was eating as a kid, not so much. And the coolest new thing is that they're launching a brand new high-protein granola. And true to the Magic Spoon promise, it's packed with protein and it's crunchy. Now, I got to Magic Spoon because of the cereal. I stayed because of the treats. Now, Magic Spoon's high-protein treats are crispy, crunchy, airy, and an easy way to get 12 grams of protein on the go. They come in flavors like marshmallow, chocolate, peanut butter, and dark chocolate. And then on top of that, I'm telling you, the granola packs are really cool. Magic Spoons, their new granola pack, 13 grams of protein and zero added sugars. And they come in flavors like dark chocolate almond, honey almond, peanut butter. If you're looking for a snack that is also wholesome, you need Magic Spoon. Get $5 off your next order at magicspoon.com/people or look for Magic Spoon on Amazon or your nearest grocery store. That's magicspoon.com/people for $5 off.
My news, unfortunately, is about bird flu or the avian flu, which we anticipate might be the next global health pandemic, and specifically about the Department of Health and Human Services pulling hundreds of millions of dollars of funding to support Moderna in developing a vaccine. And the rationale that HHS gave for that decision is that the development of that vaccine is using messenger RNA, so mRNA, which, as you know, was also how we developed the COVID vaccine. And they claim that it is under-tested and unproven. And they say that this is a matter of safety, integrity, and trust. And that is one decision, right? Like to pull funding for development of a vaccine that could help us get in front of, prevent, or combat the next emerging sort of global pandemic is one. But on top of that, you know, RFK Jr. and Dr. Oz together have made this group of ostriches that have been exposed to the bird flu in Canada, a group of animals that they are really going to the mat for, right? So I'm going to connect these two things in a second. So there's a group of ostriches on a farm that have been exposed to bird flu. The Canadian government has said that the owners of that farm must cull or kill those ostriches. And RFK Jr. and Dr. Oz are like, no, don't kill them. They've been exposed to bird flu but have survived. We should study them. What if we moved them to the United States? What if we put them on a farm in Florida, Dr. Oz's farm? As context, over the last 3 years, Canada and British Columbia, actually, in particular, has lost 8.7 million birds to the bird flu, right? And that's like half of all total of Canada. So this is like not a small thing. And so people in Canada are like, we got to kill these birds, y'all, so that bird flu doesn't kill us. And RFK Jr. and Dr. Oz are like, what if we move them to the United States, where we are also preventing further research and development of a bird flu vaccine? And so I just wanted to bring those two stories together because I'm trying to connect the dots myself and figure out what is really happening here. You know, for a long time, I was like, oh, this is a eugenics play. Like, this is just them being like, my DNA is strong and I will survive this and your DNA is weak and you will not. But there's something about the desire to import sick birds or potentially sick birds that feels especially, I just can't connect the dots. So I'm hoping y'all can help me there.
The dots are not to be connected.
So we're not going to develop a vaccine for the bird flu. We're going to import birds that have been exposed to the bird flu, and some of them are likely sick. Some of them in the wobble, which, by the way, I learned is the term for a group of ostriches, a wobble, have definitely been exposed to and are likely sick. And we're going to move them to the United States. I just can't make sense of it.
Okay. So if your mind is a cabinet and you have different materials in this cabinet, there are some stories that call for some tinfoil, right? Now, just listening to like what Bill Gates has said about the inevitability of another pandemic, right? Which the Black community cannot handle another, like, you know, once we add a fascist moment like this on top of a natural disaster, we can't really survive another 2020 as a society. But also in the same way, Bill Gates is saying, well, that's inevitable. I think about that. And then I also think about the United States collusion with crack. I think of the United States collusion when it comes to when AIDS was happening, how that was being ignored. And I'm also thinking about the right-wing extremist doctrine that so many of these politicians are either harmonized with or are master teachers of, right? And if you think that we're not in a government that will engineer its own certain people's own demise, and that that's not interesting to certain parts of the government, I think that we're being really, really, really naive. That's where my mind goes. My mind goes not just that we want to be able to cure American people, but we also want to make sure that certain American people die because they're not doing it quick enough with the diabetes and the bad food and the bad air. So we need to be able to engineer America being... I just think the goal is for America to be a vacation land for the hyper-wealthy. In the same way we're seeing that micro happen in New York City, I think that the plan is for all of America to be like that.
Miles, maybe we need to switch tinfoil hats on this one because I'm going to put on my super tinfoil hat in this moment. And say, I actually think your point earlier applies here where, like, the strategy is no strategy. And I think that, like, you know... Let me tell you my point at the end. My point at the end is this idea that, like, the arrogance of white supremacy is also, like, an attack on expertise, which I think is, like, a thing for the white supremacists. But they remind me of the people when I used to work in the school system in Baltimore. And, you know, we had 10,000 employees and I worked at Human Capital. And every year we get one employee who would get hired at the district who would come in and just know they knew how to do it better. We've been doing this and we have tried every, like, anything that's not going well is because we sort of have done it as well as we can make it happen. But they will come in and they're like, you know what? The payroll thing, I'm going to press these 7 buttons and break the whole system. But they just knew, didn't ask no questions. They just knew they knew how to do it better than you. And I'm saying, like, these Black people who worked in this office before I was born have way more, they know how to keep this ship running in a way that you certainly don't know how to do, and you've been here for 5 minutes and ain't been in no meetings. And there is an arrogance that I see from this group of people that's like, the government couldn't be that hard. Like, I could just come in and me and my whiteness, no skill or experience, just has to know how to do this. So I think that, to me, is a part of it. The, you know, RFK, so Sharonda, thank you for bringing this. I missed this in all the craziness. I'm still stuck on RFK saying he's going to find a cure for autism by September. I mean, a cause for autism by September. And then he's like walking that back being like, JK, JK. And you're like, this, or Jeanine Pirro from Fox News being appointed the U.S. attorney in D.C. You're like, what? This is... just the loony bin, but I do think there's this arrogance, you know, because y'all, I wouldn't even take a job I knew I couldn't do. Like, don't even put me in a role. I can't do it. But that white supremacy is like, oh no, me being white is actually the only qualification you need. And that's why, did you see the deputy director of the FBI was talking about how hard the job is? He's busy. He doesn't see his wife often. You're like, well, what did you think it was going to be as the deputy director of the FBI, sir?
Seriously.
I think people just desire to see new things in, like, their Twitter, Instagram bio. I think that is something that's infiltrated all. I do wish that, because almost like your reading on it, DeRay, like, makes it more innocent. And I think, like, in the same way that Trump is the clown, the jester that covers up the very real, very serious evil, I think all of them kind of function in the same way. I think RFK Jr., all these people. So I think I look at RFK Jr. as the jester saying wild things. But then, I'll bring up Mike Johnson because he scares me a lot. So I think about the Mike Johnson. I think about the companies. I think about the lobbyists that are behind those people. And those people are intelligent and wicked.
Thank you for calling out the innocence. Not my intent. I actually think that the wickedness is like you would only do this because the people the government really serves don't matter.
Yeah. Mm.
That's why it's like a playground. Because you would, what you wouldn't do is run a business like this. You wouldn't hire a Fox personality to run the mailroom at your office. But you will run the, you will hire them to be the head of the FBI, the head of Health and Human Services.
Yeah,
because the rich people won't need the government in that way. So it doesn't really matter what happens. Just like, I don't know if you saw with Doge. It just came out that Doge, I mean, obviously we knew Doge was a scam, but Doge saved no money. And the deficit has ballooned to historic high when Doge was supposed to be cutting costs.
Yep.
And you're like, could you imagine if a Black person did that or like the left did something so crazy? All these people laid off, ain't got no jobs because Elon Musk was like, just kidding.
I don't think that's what it ever was about. Like, I think that was a distraction. I think we won't know until 20 years later, if PBS or 60 Minutes even exist, what he was actually doing with all of our data. I think that that was just a cover-up. And, oh, you didn't fix anything. And you said you were going to fix anything. Yeah, I lied again, dumbass. Like, that's what I do. And I'm lying again. And now, if that's why when we think about voting machines, when we think about anything with our personal data, he just did an intense AI system of, like, who knows how we're vulnerable because of that moment.
You see the announcement that just happened this week about Palantir, that the government is now giving all the information for every American from Social Security to Palantir to create the super database of American citizens.
I miss that.
Going to the company owned by Peter Thiel. Yeah, Palantir just got it. It is interesting because it's one of the few things that the MAGA people are calling out as like, wow, this was one big scam. But to your point, Miles, it seems like we actually know the answer quicker than people thought. Yeah, it's going to be a master database on every American is what Palantir is just getting access to. So maybe you needed to fire all those people so you could just get the data quick enough so that nobody would know.
And I guess, again, just thinking about what happened in 2020, when we think about being underneath a Trump presidency, what's happening now in 2025. And I mean, I'm talking to y'all too, but I'm also just talking to anybody who maybe is scared of this kind of shadow, but this doesn't really scare me. In 15 years scares me because there's so much footwork being done to make sure that the next neoliberal fascist wave that really gives Nazi Germany, you know, like you're kind of just seeing that happen. I'm like, I don't know how you survived that.
This is tilling the soil.
You know? And I'm like, that's to me what all of this is doing. We're going to be begging Kai to be on his on his stream and be like, we got to talk to people. Kai, please let me on. He's going to be like, you a whack YN. I'm like, damn.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
So I got a tweet from my favorite war criminal. Just joking. I saw this tweet of Obama come up and it sparked my interest. It didn't get as much traction as you would hope. I mean, Obama is like deeply famous, obviously, but I just think that also shows how the algorithm, even for President Obama, is not where it should be. Because to me, this should have 100 of thousands of interactions and stuff, or maybe it's just proof that it's exhausted. But anywho, President Obama put out a tweet about an article around AI. And I wanted to bring this here because I haven't quite seen enough Black folks talking about it and then also filtering what these facts then mean for your average Black person when it comes to AI. So I'll just tell you what Dario Amodei has said. He's the CEO of Anthropic, one of the world's most powerful creators of artificial intelligence. So he says, AI could wipe out half of all entry-level white-collar jobs and spike unemployment to 10 to 20% in the next 1 to 5 years. So he also said companies and government need to stop sugarcoating what's coming, the possible mass elimination of jobs across technology, finance, laws, consulting, and other white-collar professions, especially entry-level jobs. So one of the reasons why I thought this was interesting with Kai was because I'm thinking to myself, well, what would I tell a young 18-year-old where to go? And if they think that they can make it on the internet in whatever capacity, I would say, you should try that. It doesn't feel like an irresponsible, illogical thing to assert, specifically with news like this. The other thing is, too, because obviously he was speaking from America and all of our population, but we know that these kind of moments impact Black people worse. We know that if this is going to be bad for the average white American or the average American, quote unquote, it's going to be disastrous for the Black community. And I think that we, in my ways, not just to do like shadow work here on the podcast, but I feel like we haven't translated that in ebony. We haven't translated what this means for Black America, and it's scary. And I remember we talked last, or maybe a few weeks ago, about that New York Times article on Black men in college. And part of my argument is always like, how could we, with good conscience, even suggest going to college to your average Black person or to your average Black man if we know that what they're inheriting is nothing and AI is eating up the little bit of nothing that they were inheriting, let alone the things that you have to do to assimilate into these cultures that feel antagonistic to being a Black man often, who you have to be in order to succeed in these different institutions. And yeah, I just wanted to bring it to the pod. I wanted to hear y'all's thoughts about it. I wanted to maybe even hear through y'all's own work how you're seeing AI both benefit but also maybe become a detriment. What are maybe some solutions? What would you tell the average 17, 18-year-old? Because it does remind me of when I was 17 and 18 and we inherited the recession. You know, I was born in 91. September 11th happened in 2001, and very quickly we were inheriting a world that was so different in like a year or two than the one that we thought we were going to be inheriting when I was talking to my guidance counselor. And we see a lot of millennials, and we can talk about the avocado toast millennials, but your average millennial is just living in poverty. That's what's going on, you know? And we can talk about people like the three of us who have been able to work the impossible. But the average person who came from that era is in poverty. And then when we look at the drug rates and we look at fentanyl rates, when we look at in the Black gay community, the Black queer community, how many of us are on meth? And when we think about why people use drugs, I'm like, this next wave of what AI is going to do to us as an economy and as a Black culture, it's really scary. And I wanted to hear y'all's reflection on it.
In education, I think what we're seeing is like young people, especially in K-12, say to us that a lot of how we assess their understanding of something is obsolete, right? They're just like, I'll just ask ChatGPT to write this essay, or I'll just, you know, add these questions to it and it'll spit out the answers for me. And, you know, I read an interview a few weeks ago with a young person who had been denied admission to Columbia and was like fighting to get in on appeal. And the reporter was like, why do you care? You've already said you're just going to use AI to do all of your assignments. And he was like, well, because you go to an Ivy League school to meet your co-founder and your spouse. Like, that's why I want to go, right? And so I think young people, because I work in education, right, are already ahead of us on this. They're like, I don't actually need this skill or need to understand this concept. Like, I need access. I need relationships, because then I can start this thing or, you know, build an audience or build my personal brand. And that's already how young people are thinking about their place in the world and how they plan to or hope to make it, right? And I think it's those of us who are in charge of their educations or stewarding them into adulthood who are behind and who are caught on our back foot in this moment. You know, Miles, I also think, though, it's not just about like these sort of like white collar or like entry level, like data entry jobs, or, you know, you might have been a copy editor or whatever, right, to get your start in publishing, whatever the thing is. I think we've also seen it in like creative pursuits and in industries and fields, right? And I think, you know, people have been talking about the use of, for instance, like AI to generate Black models, right? Also a pathway that a lot of Black people use to like build careers, brands, make it to fame, make it to wealth, right? Like, there is no Naomi Campbell or Tyra Banks if you can just use AI to generate a Black model for you, you know? Similarly around music, right? And using AI to make music now and having AI artists, right? We know that the first people who are going to be sort of duplicated or replicated in those spaces are going to be Black artists. The same thing with like how we make art, right? And I'll share with y'all offline this article about the implosion of like the Black portraiture market. I don't know if you all saw that a few weeks ago too, but just like the devaluing of Black art altogether. And I think AI is going to accelerate that. And so I'm not just worried about like the Black kids who would go into, you know, traditional fields. I'm also worried about the Black kids who would have, you know, pursued the creative arts and fields and like what opportunities are available to them. And I don't think we're talking about it enough. And I don't think we're preparing our young people to better understand that in this moment, social capital matters even more. And how do you navigate a world where you might not have access to it in the way that your white or wealthier peers do?
I'm not an AI denier, but I actually think that it'll be a divider more than a replacement. I think that the gap between exceptional and everything else will be much bigger than it's ever been. Because, you know, even at work, we have some people who, like, if they can't get to our design at work, they want to use AI. And, like, some of the stuff they can make on AI, it works. It's like, it, like, for what we need it to do, it's good. But the difference between that and what a work session is with the designer is just they are night and day. So I think that the divide between excellent and everything else will become a much bigger divide. I will say, I've been on a couple of college campuses doing talks. I don't do a lot of talks anymore, but I have recently. And the number of kids I talk to who are like, oh, I just AI, da da da, who I watch lack critical thinking skills because they never read the essay. They're like, oh, I read this book. I'm like, oh, what did you think about? And it's like, oh, you didn't read the book, actually. You wrote a paper on, or you read the Cliff Note. You don't even know what Cliff Notes is because you're too young. But yeah. You like essentially got Cliff Notes from AI about the text.
And I think this is my point about assessment, right? It's like, how are we testing it? Because I think if teachers stop saying, write me a 5-page essay and instead stand here and tell me about it and like engage in a critical conversation about it, we would know more and students would prep differently.
And I think that Sharana, you're a manager of people. I think impact of that on the workplace is going to be seismic. You know, the number of people who apply for things and you're like, oh, you actually can't write a paragraph. Like, this is going to be, you know, we run the Mike Brown Scholars Program and some of the kids for the scholarship application clearly use AI because, you know, most AI sounds like AI. You're like, this is a weird sentence construction. And some of them, we did phone interviews. It was like, you actually are amazing. And thank God we didn't just throw out your application. But there are going to be a lot less generous programs who will just remove a whole set of kids for using AI to assist them in this. So I think that the critical thing, as a manager of people, I'm telling you, I'm worried about the generation coming up who like every way to process knowledge was almost too easy for them. So then when something happens, it's just like, you can't, I use a real example. I'm telling you, I was in a meeting about 3 strikes laws and somebody tried to open AI me. And I was like, well, I know that number not right. So like, I wish we had taught you how to do original research because you thought this was like the quick way. And that just was the wrong, like that was wrong.
Yeah. I just want to just put a huge red alarm on this. Like, I think that we are about to be hit really hard as Black people. I think that AI, we have to also understand that we were both here in the early internet days. I still watch, was it GeoCities or Yahoo GeoCities or whatever. But like, I still like look at those kind of internet pages. And I think that we're an extremely early application. And I think that what AI is able to do, like he said, in 1 to 5 years will change. I know that even with my use of AI, AI has gotten more sophisticated with how it's done things. And the last thing I'll say to button this in, that's just regular old capitalism talk, but I've been using 11 Labs on my new projects that I've been working on.
Shout out to 11 Labs, baby. Has gotten much better than when they first started. It is incredible.
in such a quick amount of time, but what I wanted to say with 11 Labs as well is So each essay that I'm creating, without like kind of saying too much, each essay I'm creating is like a different Black voice, right? And so I'm like looking for these African-American voices. Most of the African-American voices that I choose point two times or three times more of the cost. So on 11 Labs, you pay whatever, 1,000 points for this generation. Then usually with the person's African-American, it'll be 2,000 or 3,000. And I thought that was an interesting moment that shows you that capitalism will survive all.
So here's my news, y'all. You know, it really is sort of an interesting, it's an interesting moment that happens with all of the Trump stuff because you look up and you're like, well, this is sort of, so wild that I have to like check a couple sources to be like, is this actually what's happening? So remember, Trump is suing Paramount because he said that they edited the interview of Kamala, the 60 Minutes interview. There was no editing of the 60 Minutes interview. They released the full interview. It wasn't edited, blah, 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 blah. But Trump has commandeered the court. So Paramount and Trump are in this legal battle. One of the things being proposed as a part of the settlement, it's a $20 billion lawsuit, is that the Trump administration will be able to run PSAs for free on the Paramount News Networks. And I read it and I was like, what? Like, it's just so obviously corrupt and so obviously propaganda. And the thing he's suing over did not happen. That it was not, like, they did not make her look better. Like, it just, the crime that they apparently committed, it was not real. And I bring it because A, I was shocked. And I'm like, this is nuts. And then B, you know, I feel like I said it on another episode, but I was in an Uber in New York City. And as I'm getting out, like we pull up to stop, I hear Kristi Noem's voice, the Secretary of Homeland Security. And I'm looking at my immigrant driver like, why are you listening to Fox News? Like, what's going on with you? And then I realize he doesn't have Fox News on. This is just an ad that the federal government is running on the radio, black radio stations. And I'm like, this really is a full court press in a way that if I was not in an Uber or a Lyft, I wouldn't even know. You know, because when I'm driving a car, I put on Spotify. I'm not listening to ads or anything. I'm like, oh, y'all get, like, part of what makes the Republicans work, and I think, Miles, you said this earlier in a different way, is that it really is a, like, overwhelm you with so much stuff that you can't focus on the crazy stuff because it's just so much. But they also know that they got to keep it up. That, like, you know, they're doing such heinous stuff that, like, the onslaught of overwhelm actually has to be sustained as well. And when I heard the ad, she's talking about, like, you know, illegal immigrants and people and all this stuff. And I was like, if I didn't know any better, I would believe it. Because why would the government run ads that lied? Like, that is, I don't know, like, that feels like a real question. So I brought this up because I was frankly shocked at how far some of the stuff has gotten in the courts, given that he has just commandeered the courts and that PSAs favorable to the Trump administration is actually on the table.
Before you chime in, Miles, I just want to say to people who are listening that sometimes I wish we were a video podcast so y'all could see Miles's disappointment every time DeRay and I say things like shocked, disappointed, confused.
I try to cover up so well. That's so funny that you said that.
Oh, my God. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm just thinking like, oh, this middle passage. it's been a long ride, child. It's been a long ride. It's been a long ride. So here's the thing to me. I think that we've been in such a cultural media ecosystem that somebody being so bold with the propaganda shakes us. Right. But I think it's healthy that we see that just with a couple of bold, confident choices, we too can be North Korea. You know, like we're not as far as a gap as sometimes the American propaganda wants us to think. We're always seen we're free. You can say whatever you want, free speech and all this other stuff. And we know that there's certain people who won't be able to speak. We know that there's people, I mean, DeRay, I know that you won't say this thing. Maybe you don't even feel this way, but I feel this way for you for what it's worth in 2024 during the election. I saw that certain voices were iced out, namely people who do work like in criminal justice like you do, and how in one moment a voice was silenced, and that's true for what you do and also for Palestinians, transgender people, but that kind of illusion of free speech is so easily turned down when we need it. But I think the Trump thing is somebody who's taking advantage of that in a way that feels alarming. But I think to me, what's most scary is that the driver's reaction was normal. That to me is the scary part. That's not that the commercial happened, but that I'm pretty sure your driver was just chilling, driving you to work. And to me, that's what's alarming, that people don't see that there's a zombie apocalypse. They just think that the zombies are, you know, I guess hipsters with
with different makeup.
Yeah, I think we've also talked about like how much the Trump administration just lies, right? And like, even if you have evidence to the contrary, like when we were talking about the arrest of Roz Baraka and other elected officials, right? They will just repeat the lie. And it's interesting because part of what's happening with Paramount going along with this is allowing the lie to stand uncontested, right? And so what ends up happening as a result of this decision is like the narrative of them having been quote unquote unfair to Trump is sticky. It's going to stay now because they're playing ball and the Trump administration has set the terms of the game and they're not contesting them. And so it's just, it's a way that history will remember when people are like, dang, CBS aired a whole lot of pro-Trump stuff, right? Or CBS aired a whole bunch of stuff that's aligned with Trump's priorities and policies. People will be like, well, they had to because, you know, they screwed him over, right? And that will be what people remember. And that is how we, despite, to your point, DeRay, having aired the entire interview and us being like, no, actually, that's not what they did. How history will remember, how this will be cemented in our collective memories and collective discourse is that they were unfair to him, that they did the wrong thing, that they tried to give an upper hand to Kamala. And that is just, it's a masterful, masterful controlling of the narrative and of public memory.
I think in 20 or 30 years, I think there's going to be people who are like, oh my goodness, CBS and these different places used to be bipartisan. They used to like not be like, I think that we're just destroying what journalistic integrity or what is objective. I think that all that's being destroyed, and there's going to be new 18-year-old and new voters who are just used to there being a hyper-politicized lying government that always seems to think that they're the hero and everything else is the villain. I think that's going to be normal.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.